I'll try to speak loudly, which is difficult. So here's the challenge. Imagine we have some stuff, some kind of quantum stuff. And I asked my wife to go and get some Play-Doh, but this was the best she could find. So this is some sort of modeling clay. And then the question is it possible to use it to do quantum computing? Maybe not this, but maybe something else. So the answer is clearly yes, if the stuff has the right properties, which is an important caveat. And then the question is, well, how do we find out if it has the right properties? If we know it has the right properties, then how do you use this stuff to actually do quantum computing? So I'm going to propose operational computing with quantum stuff, and these are very preliminary results. So I noticed that so far everybody who's won the Bell Prize has also done experiments as well as theoretical work. So I thought I should start to build up my portfolio. So I didn't actually get around to booting up the experiment. But here's the idea. You can see the idea. You attach some inputs and outputs. Just as a matter of nomenclature, I call the inputs settings and the outcomes, sorry, and the outputs outcomes, because I want to use the word inputs and outputs or something else later. So this was set up on the kitchen table. It turned out the cheese grater was not very useful. And then can we use this to do quantum computing? Okay, well, here's the plan of how it might work. So first of all, you need to make some assumptions about the stuff, what kind of properties it has. I think if you make no assumptions, you can get nowhere. So you make some assumptions. Of course, you can test your assumptions, but you need to make some assumptions to get started. Then you use these assumptions to build an appropriate framework. Then you use a classical computer to send signals. Remember, you had a classical computer here. I have to point with something. Unfortunately, today technology is not on my side. Good. You use the classical computer, send signals to the classical stuff to characterize it, do some tomography. Then you set up some kind of error correcting blocks. I'll show you what I mean by that later. And you try to construct the universal gate set. Meanwhile, you write down the program that you intend to run on your quantum computer in some canonical gate set. So you have a canonical idea of what your computer will do. Now you need to transcribe your program from the canonical gate set into the gate set that you've constructed up here, and then you run it and you do the quantum computation. Notice most of these boxes just have a black box in representing that it's a classical computation. A few of them have this representing that you're sending signals to and from the quantum stuff. Okay, I'll come back to this slide repeatedly during the presentation. So really a key point of this talk is that we want to set up an operational framework that's more general than quantum theory. And then within the context of that operational framework, we can measure the kind of things we want to measure. So I've drawn a graph of x versus t. So imagine, so x is running along the bottom here. And then imagine at each time, is the microphone working now? No, okay. Imagine at equal time intervals, we send an input in, and this is represented by the green dot, and we read some output. So we have a setting in, and we have an outcome out, okay, represented by a red dot. We do that in each position, and we do it repeatedly over time. So now take this and draw this. Okay, I've just transcribed from here to here. And I'm going to think of this as a circuit. So I'll say more about what I mean by this circuit in a moment. We're going to associate, and this is really just a sort of theoretical association, systems with wires. So if you look at this circuit here, the basic object is what you might call an operation. It has a box, it has some wires going into it, and some wires going out of it. And then we have an input, which previously I represented by a green dot, or sorry, a setting, which I previously represented by a green dot. Here it's an arrow. And we have a classical output, or an outcome, previously represented by a red dot. Okay. These inputs and outputs here, these are the wires, come in different types, which you might imagine, although it doesn't really matter, you might imagine are associated with different types of quantum system. Also, we allow that the inputs and outputs can be open or closed. And there's some subtlety concerning what that means. So this is a brief review of what I mean by the circuit model. I gave a longer talk on this, which you can watch on the Perimeter Institute recorded seminar archive. Just a quick bit of advertising. In that case, I was showing how you could use this model to derive quantum theory from a set of natural postulates. There's also a more general framework that I call the Kozloff framework, which is geared towards quantum gravity. And it may be that actually that more general framework would be more useful for the present purpose. That's an even more general operational framework. For the moment, this is the circuit model. So here's the idea. We have circuits, which are things like this. We imagine that there are no open inputs or outputs. So every output is either wired in or closed, like here. We imagine there are no closed loops. So as you go from output to input, it's impossible to trace back and go round again. So here we go output to input, and then we can't get back down here again. We imagine that probabilities are well defined. What I mean by this is that the probability associated with the given set of outcomes for this circuit, the red arrows, I haven't drawn them in here, or the green arrows, are independent of the knob settings, of the settings elsewhere. So imagine we have this circuit, then over here somewhere else we have another circuit which also has some settings. We imagine the settings on the other circuit do not influence the settings on this circuit. And then finally, we imagine that this probability here does not change if we open up some of these outputs like so and add some extra circuitry on. So that's the basic model. So what's interesting is you can show, just starting with these assumptions here, you can show very generally that it's possible to associate a matrix of, this is a matrix of real number entries, with each operation like this. So the matrix has labels associated with the inputs, labels associated with the outputs, and also a label associated with the setting and the outcome, and also, of course, the operation type. And it's such that you can write down the probability for a circuit with an expression like this. So notice the outputs and inputs have to match here. Also notice that this is closed, so there's no inputs going in and no outputs coming out. This equation an example of this equation. You can find it in quantum theory. There's a linear relationship between the quantities here and the quantities here in the case of quantum theory. So quantum theory would be an example in this general framework. And in fact, this general matrix in quantum theory, you can represent it if you know the if you know the super operator, the CP map associated with the operation, then you can calculate using this formula the matrix. So another assumption. Once assumed that local tomography is possible. This is something which is true in quantum theory. What it means is that if you want to determine the state of a composite system, then it's sufficient to make local measurements on each of the subsystems. This is true in quantum theory. In fact, it's true in quantum theory for complex Hilbert space. It's not true for real Hilbert space, which is a curious fact. If you make that assumption that local tomography is possible, then you can show that for disjoint operations, so here's a disjoint, here's an operation that's composed of two disjointed parts, you can show that you can write the matrix for this operation as the tensor product of a matrix for each of the components operations. And this is very useful. You can use it to break up a calculation for the probability of a circuit. Let me show you that. So here's a circuit. What you do is you choose some sort of foliation through the circuit, so you divide it into time steps. Then in each time step, you use the tensor product to multiply together the matrices for each of the operations, and then you can calculate the probability associated with the whole circuit. Okay, so that's the circuit model. So now let's go through how this is going to work. First of all, we make some assumptions about the stuff. So here are the assumptions. We assume that the circuit model applies and that we have the correct circuit. So it's possible that the circuit model applies, but we have the wrong circuit. It may be that there are also some wires, for example, going from here to here. In other words, it's possible that the speed of transmission inside our stuff is faster than we thought. That's an easy problem to rectify. You just you draw a better circuit, or you modify your thing in such a way that that assumption is now valid. Second, we assume that local tomography is possible because I want to have this tensor product property. And third, and this is a big assumption and one that I think you would really want to relax if you're going to make any real progress, we assume that the stuff is homogeneous in a certain way. So, for example, if we have the same setting and the same outcome here and here, then we assume that we have the same Z matrix associated with it, so for any of these boxes. So that's just saying it has the same properties across the length of this stuff. That assumption might make more sense if you had a circular rather than linear geometry in the first place. But in any case, I think ultimately if you wanted to pursue this program, you would have to work out how to relax that kind of assumption. Now we imagine using the classical computer to characterize the stuff, to do tomography, to determine what the Z matrices are. So how would we do that? Well, we could choose some subset of the possible settings at each operation. You choose a subset intelligently. If you have a continuous parameter on your settings, it doesn't make sense to choose every infinitesimal division of that. Then we'd run the computer for some time, and we could choose the settings randomly. So we'd have L times T settings. L is the length of the wire, and T is the time it runs for. And if we did that, we'd get a table consisting of the settings we chose, these random settings, and then the outcomes. And now we process that table to determine the Z matrix for each type of operation we have, for each phi, each setting and outcome. So this last step is going to require an algorithm, which will basically be some sort of linear compression, which we don't have time to go into. There's also a subtle point here. We need to understand what we mean by closing inputs in this circuit model. Basically, closing an input will be something like initializing your computer in the right way. So there's a subtle point there that needs to be addressed. Next, we consider error correcting blocks. So we take our circuit, I've drawn it again here, and then we consider blocks of some size. Here we have two species of blocks, just because I couldn't get one to tessellate, one type of thing to tessellate. And then that's equivalent to this kind of coarse-grained diagram. And now we can calculate, in this general framework, the Z matrix associated with each of these blocks. So we just use the formula that I gave before. I was lazy, so I didn't write in actual labels for the wires. But we have a matrix for this one. Then here we use the tensor product rule to get the matrix for this. And then here we have the usual, the matrix for this one. So this matrix is now the matrix associated with this block. In other words, it's the matrix associated with one of these, or actually one of the yellow ones. You could do the same thing for the green ones. So in this way, we will obtain a large set of matrices which correspond to realizable transformations. Okay, so so the next few steps, one could divide up this in different ways, but let's go about it like this. So now the question is, do we have amongst the matrices that we just constructed in this step, do we have a universal gate set? So we require some general theory, a general algorithm, to test whether a given set of gates contains or allows universal computation. So I don't know if there's a solution to that problem, and I haven't solved it. There's also, of course, going to be a precision issue in here that needs to be addressed. Okay, so meanwhile, we want to program the computer in the canonical, so we want to write down a program in the canonical quantum computer. So what we need is some canonical gate set along with an allowed wiring. So here's a universal gate set. It's overcomplete, I think. But if you take each of these two qubit gates and you're allowed to plug them here into these positions, then you can do universal quantum computation. Since we have a restricted allowed wiring, we have to include things like the identity and the swap gate. It's interesting to think about what you need to include in your gate set where you have restricted wirings. So next we need to transcribe the program that we just wrote with respect to this canonical gate set. We need to transcribe it into we need to transcribe it into the gate set that we constructed for our quantum stuff. So again, we need to do some theoretical work to find an algorithm for this. Actually, the two problems, the problem of finding an algorithm here and this one, I think, are going to be related, essentially the same problem. And I haven't solved that, and I don't know if the solution is out there somewhere in the literature. And then the sixth step, the final step, is we do the computation. So the program will consist of a timed sequence of settings at each wire. So this is the program coming in here. And this time sequence come from the transcribed program, where we transcribed the program from the canonical quantum computer into the computer that we constructed by tomography. Oh, of course, there's an important box here, this fail box. So I'm rather suspecting that the particular quantum computer I showed you at the beginning will belong to this box. So that's the case where actually you're unable to construct the universal gate set. So an important question is going to be whether one can relax the homogeneity assumption. with this assumption, it's easy to allow yourself some finite large amount of time and get reasonably good precision that should enable you to calculate, to do many quantum computations. Without that assumption, you probably will have problems. And then the questions are, well, what if you only have homogeneity in time, but not in space? Or what if you have some kind of systematic drift, where the parameters associated with this drift are something you can measure? Maybe then you can do this. So the conclusions. So we've set up a basic and obviously very preliminary framework for operational computing with quantum stuff. There are lots of open theoretical questions that that remain. So can we deal with the non-homogeneous case? How do we characterize whether or not a set of gates would allow universal computation? How do we transcribe from some set of states, some set of gates that we've constructed tomographically, how do we transcribe to that from a canonical quantum computation? If this sort of thing works, then it could sidestep a lot of problems in building a quantum computer. So if there are systematic algorithms that you can program in the classical part of this computation, then that could sidestep having to think about error correction and fault tolerance. It may be that all of that is just a matter of getting the correct sort of linear programming or whatever it is that's required in your algorithms, and then you don't have to think about it. You let the classical computer do it. Another possibility is this may work not just for quantum stuff, but it may be useful for classical stuff. You could imagine that you had some stuff that had classical properties, but which you imagined was better as a classical computer than any classical computer you happen to have. And then it might be useful to run this same process, characterize that, and then use it to assist a smaller classical computer. Okay, thank you.